Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Welcome to Podcast Deluxe, your big things coming to LLC of weekly cultural review. I'm John Caramonica.
I'm Joe Coscarelli.
We are co-hosts of a spinoff of podcast Original Recipe, which nytimes.com/podcast, for those who aren't familiar. Every week, Joe and I will be coming to you with songs of the week, what's going on social media, big news in music, television, etc. What else we got for the people?
Snacks?
I mean, first of all, it really took all the restraint that we had not to make this a full snack cast.
Yep.
Just want to say that. Yep. But there will be snacks. We are basically doing things that we can't exactly do on Popcast Regular. Popcast Regular, we take one or two big topics every episode. We're talking to outside experts, but there's a lot that we can't get to. This is going to be more of a rundown of the things that are happening every week out there in the industry, on the charts, on your phones.
That's it. Yeah. Bonus content. Prime. Also, we're on YouTube.
Oh, yes.
That's the main new
thing. This is what we look like,
yeah.
In case you're unfamiliar, in case you haven't stopped us at the 100 Gek show, for example.
Right.
A real thing that happened. So this is what we look like. We'll be on YouTube.com every week. We're going to be coming. And speaking of charts, YouTube stars, success.
Controversy.
Should we talk about Morgan Wallen?
I think we have to talk about Morgan Wallen. Again.
Yeah. It's every day.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Morgan Wallen persists in many different respects in our culture, not all of them good.
Right.
I think there's a lot to unpack with his continued dominance in the face of controversy after controversy.
Let's talk about where we are right now. Recent Morgan Wallen album is called One Thing at a Time.
Mm-hmm.
11 weeks at the top of the Billboard 200, which is, say, the most popular album in the country, owing to streaming success, country radio success. It goes on and on and on. Wallen also has the number one song in the country.
Last night. 7 weeks at the top of the Billboard Hot 100, you know, holding at bay hits by
everybody.
Lil Durk and J. Cole came in at number 2 this week behind Morgan Wallen.
But Lil Durk knows perfectly well. We're going to get to Lil Durk and Morgan Wallen in just a moment. If anybody knows the power of Morgan Wallen, it's Lil Durk. So let's actually give a little bit of a précis of why this is unusual, right? So Morgan Wallen, when Dangerous, the double album, came out, was captured on video by a neighbor after a raucous night out using a racial slur.
Right.
TMZ picks this up, and the Morgan Wallen industry at that moment shuts down.
He already had his previous album was the biggest album out. It was the dawn of a new country pop superstar.
Yes.
He had everything going for him. He had recently hosted SNL, and then he's caught on video using a racial slur after a drunken night out. And yes, the label says he's suspended. Which, like, it's not a thing that music labels do, but fine. Radio stops playing the songs.
Right.
People stop writing about him. He's uninvited from award shows. It came at a particularly heated moment where,
in like the grand sort of racial reckoning,
and Nashville specifically, sort of
a town that is not historically engaged with. Right. Racial politics in a way that would be understood as progressive and necessary.
Right. And yet, he just kept getting more popular.
Yeah. And I want to say something about Morgan Wallen the musician versus Morgan Wallen the culture war hero. So later that year, Morgan Wallen did eventually get back out on the road. And I went to one of those shows. I actually went to two of those shows. Because I wanted to see what that looked like.
Yeah.
And the thing that I was consistently struck by was Wallen was not the culture war soldier on stage. people saw that in him. People thought his ongoing success was really like sticking it to the man.
Right. He became a poster boy for outlasting cancel culture.
Yes.
Basically.
Right. And sort of country music loves its version of outlaws. And whether in the 70s, that's a different kind of outlaw, but really we're talking about the 2000s era outlaws, like your Toby Keiths of the world.
Right.
Country music is still like particularly like riven through with that kind of energy, and the fan base I think really responds to it a lot.
It's a conservative culture.
Tilts in that way.
It tilts in a conservative direction.
And so Wallen becoming kind of like a conservative hero, I was not surprised to see that in the crowd. I was maybe expecting to see more of it on stage.
Right.
It's not on stage, or at least in that tour. He is currently sort of on a stadium tour. This is where we arrive today, right? Like Morgan Wallen selling out stadiums, the number one album in the country, the number one song in the country. Some percentage of that, I'm sure, is an energized fan base that wants to support him because it thinks that's what fighting cancel culture means.
Right.
But also, Morgan Wallen is generally acknowledged to be a pretty good country musician who makes popular songs that people enjoy.
Yes.
So 60,000 people in a stadium is not simply...
It's not only a backlash to the backlash.
No.
It's far bigger than that.
And it's the arc that, frankly, he was on regardless. Now, all of this said, we're in an interesting moment for Morgan Wallen, right? Wallen had a show in Mississippi.
This was late April?
Yes, maybe like, yeah.
A couple weeks
three,
ago.
4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
The opening acts play. And then all of a sudden, he burgers the show.
Right. Burger.
Sex Carrie, and the City burger.
Carrie Bradshaw, ex-boyfriend.
Burger broke up with me on a Post-it.
I'm sorry. I can't. Don't hate me. That should be our thing, is you and I saying,
quoting Sex and the City.
Yeah. That should be our thing. And then
he
notes apped. He notes apped an apology. That was basically like, I lost my voice. And there was some confusion or maybe misinformation or correct information that perhaps he had been drinking or had been out and about and carousing, and that's why he lost his voice. We don't exactly know. The public explanation is he lost his voice.
Right.
And then he canceled six more weeks of shows, or postponed six more weeks of shows.
In between, he played some shows. He played a couple shows in Florida, I believe. Early May, he comes out with a statement.
Everything's fair game in Florida, as you know.
Fine. Saying that he'd injured his vocal cords and he was pausing what is, you know, one of the biggest tours of the year.
Yeah. I mean, outside of the Taylor tour, it probably is the biggest tour of the year. I'm struggling to think of a tour that's bigger.
Beyonce?
Sure.
Yeah. They're up there.
Right.
Yeah. A plus 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 list superstars of popular music.
Right. So Wallen's going to come back on the road sometime in June, maybe, or July, one of the vocal cords heal up. To what degree do we feel like Wallen's persistent success, what kind of problems does this pose?
I feel like the question is, what will stop him? What can stop Morgan Wallen?
Right.
Like, he's tried...
Should he be stopped?
I'm not saying that he should be stopped. I'm just saying... He got bigger. He comes back with a Mea Culpa album that's maybe a little bit worse than the previous one.
Like, quality-wise?
Yeah, I don't... Yeah. I mean...
Yes, I think it's a... As music, I think it's a very good album, but it is not as good as Dangerous, the double album.
And it's, what, like 30-plus songs?
Yes.
He's a streaming monster.
It's a YSL compilation album.
It is a NBA Youngboy length album.
Morgan Wallen, Richest Stop?
Yes.
Wow.
And then he gets on the road, and the people who are not mad at him... So this means he's been like sort of written out of polite society, like left-leaning culture, coastal, elite, whatever you want to call them.
But also sponsorships.
Yes.
Like, is no Morgan Wallen at... He's not selling something.
He's not part of the Grammy conversation.
Songs aren't being synced in ads, even though they're the most popular songs, or at least not in ads on shows that I watch.
Right. And then he comes back and greets his public, the people who have not abandoned him, who have in fact rallied even more behind him.
Yeah.
And he basically, you know, again, maybe...
Could be real.
Yeah, vocal, whatever. He didn't treat his vocal cords well enough
to survive 30 weeks
a stadium tour. Like, it's, you know, he's, it's like being, yeah, it's like being an elite athlete. Like, you have to train to be able to put on the show that these people are paying their hard earned money for. And so to see him basically let down the audience that stuck with him.
Yeah, the fans.
The fans, his diehard fans.
That's, for him, that's way more dangerous than letting down the coastal elites.
And yet, we haven't seen a slow, you know, he cancels this stadium show. People were really upset.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, people who were there, you know, people cataloged all the money they lost, you know, all the dinner at Cracker Barrel,
Airbnbs
and outfits, new boots. You know, people wanted to be reimbursed. They spent their
As someone who buys a lot of boots, like, I want to register my sympathy with those people.
I'm going to go ahead and say you've never bought boots for a Morgan Wallen concert.
I haven't.
Right.
I haven't, but I own plenty of boots.
Yeah. And yet, we have not seen any dip in the popularity of the music. And I wonder if it's a function of the way that celebrity works right now.
Okay.
Which is that people don't really know who Morgan Wallen is. I don't think most people who are listening to Last Night, which is the biggest song in the country, 7 weeks running, mm-hmm. I don't even know that it's all connected to the sort of controversy section on his Wikipedia.
So you think almost there are people for whom Morgan Wallen is a character in a drama about how a country singer should behave in 2023. And then there are people who listen to the radio.
Yes.
And there's not that much overlap between those two groups.
I think that's what you're saying. Yes. I think that he is benefiting from the fact that he is controversial in some circles, but he is not a famous person.
No.
He's not a famous personality.
In part because of after what happened in 2021, obviously he did one relatively disastrous media appearance and then absolutely fell off the face of the earth.
Right.
Visually.
Yeah.
Doesn't really even get on Instagram that much. Doesn't really tell, you know, he's not posting a lot. There's not photos of him. You're not seeing him at events. Maybe his inner crew, like Ernests and Hardy and all those people, they're
his
like
songwriters, his opening acts, his bands.
Yeah, they're like, we're here with Morgan, etc. But you're right. There's no sense of like, what's Morgan like as an individual?
Yeah, I just get the sense that there's just a major disconnect. And it sort of mirrors, you know, what's happening in a lot of this country where you can be an artist and a culture war figure and they're not always overlapping. You know what I mean? Like they can, there's two discrete versions of your persona, I guess. So my question for you is, what's next for Morgan Wallen? Like, basically, does he still have the runway to be Garth Brooks?
I don't think that you can be Garth Brooks or Taylor Swift anymore. I don't think it's exactly that. What I do think about Wallen, or at least I think the question that him and the folks who work with him are probably going to have to reckon with is, if you go out every night at these shows, let's say the fans come back. I remember I happened to be in Nashville the day after this happened. And one thing that people in Nashville were saying was like, you know, you can let down the media, you can let down the left, but you can't let down the fans.
Right.
Let's assume he comes back.
Sure.
But you go out every night and people are saying, let's go Brandon. Let's go Brandon. Right. You know,
like, USA chants at the concert, even at Madison Square Garden.
Yes, which we saw it with our own eyes.
Yeah.
If you go out every night and you are seeing those fans, at what point do you start to play to those fans? At what point do you heel turn and be like, I'm going to become this guy because these are my most ardent, loyal supporters? Now, I'm not sure that Wallen is at that decision node where he's got to make that a decision one way or the other. But I do wonder if after 50 nights on this tour, assuming the tour picks back up, seeing this and engaging with a version of this every night, is he just going to go in that direction and sort of be like, well, I am the villain. Y'all say I'm the villain. I guess I am the villain. I sort of wonder if that's what's coming.
And yet, what we hear from him musically...
Drake.
is like so down the middle. Like, yeah. Okay, as Morgan Wallen is canceling this tour, he's also putting out his second collaboration with
Lil Durk,
Chicago's own Lil Durk.
The song is called Stand By Me.
Yeah.
Okay, well, first of all, the first song, Broadway Girls.
Right.
Broadway Girls comes about because at some point, Morgan Wallen posts a snippet of something when he's still like down bad.
Yeah, in his canceled era.
Lil Durk is in the comments being like, I'll get on this.
Right.
Who knows how much Morgan Wallen Lil Durk was listening to, but apparently Unusual Bedfellows.
Musical synergy.
And Broadway Girls. You know, some people will not want to hear this. Broadway Girls, I think, is a pretty good song.
Not my favorite by either of them.
I like it. I think it's a good song. I've spent a lot of my life documenting the intersections between country and hip hop.
Right.
For better or worse.
To you.
For better or worse, I've lived that overlap for a long time. I thought it was like a pretty good song. I'm not sure what it did for either of them necessarily, but I thought as a song, I thought it was good.
It was like a toe dip back in the ocean for Wallen, though, because...
And also Lil Durk then would go on to like be interviewed by TMZ and be like, if I say he's not canceled, he's not canceled. Right.
Morgan Wallen.
Whatever that is, again, good. Cancellation.
We're using that as a shorthand.
It is a shorthand.
Yeah, and it worked. So they're doing it again. And now, who else have they brought on board?
It's a Dr. Luke production. Dr. Luke has had some other issues of his own in regards to alleged impolitic and sexually aggressive behavior with Kesha.
Yeah, still fighting it out in the courts. Mm-hmm. He's accused her of defamation after she accused him of sexually assaulting her many years ago. Still winding its way through the system. Yet Luke has come back in a huge way. And I think this song, which is actually on the new Lil Durk album. Both songs under Durk's name, primarily, which is an interesting wrinkle.
Yes.
But I wonder if it's more evidence towards your theory that Wallen is going to lean into his heel turn to bring on Dr. Luke.
Mm-hmm.
Is it like a thumb in the eye of the quote unquote liberal media that won't cover Wallen to just say, well, you're also mad at this guy and we don't care? Or is it just, we're trying to make a hit?
I actually think it's darker in a weird way than that, which is purely cynical. I think it's basically like, what is the fastest path towards pop hit making? And if it happens to go through this guy, it happens to go through this guy. But if you listen to this song is like much more aimed at like pop radio. Now, I don't know if pop radio would play, frankly, Lil Durk or Morgan Wallen on their own.
But they both want it.
They both seem to want it, and they have crafted a record that is extremely missile-focused in that direction. Now, you can have a hit now. It's a streaming hit that's not a radio. Broadway Girls was a streaming hit. It was like sort of a YouTube record.
Yeah.
It was not, to my knowledge, a radio hit in any format.
Yeah.
I don't think it was serviced to radio, or not in any classic sense.
Yeah.
This seems like something that could be serviced to radio. Is it laundering Wallen in some way? Like, if he ends up getting service to radio to pop radio and becomes kind of like a pop radio sensation, has that done some work to, like, untether him from the sort of... Does that make him beat the cancel culture allegations?
But at the same time, it's like, musically, it's laundering Lil Durk into pop radio.
It's laundering both of them.
Like,
it's not a great Wallen song. It's not a great Durk song.
It's the most sanded down version of each of them. Like, we sort of had this moment with Lil Durk with Laugh Now, Cry Later, his feature on the Drake song, which was probably his biggest mainstream look
so
up
far.
To that point. But this is not a guy who is interested in making mathematically tight Dr. Luke style music.
Yeah.
He's loved for his sort of wild emotions and sort of like untamableness, right? Artistically.
Mm-hmm.
So to hear both of them in these boxes, it's like, it's quite kind of an unholy trinity.
Although I will say, if it's the same exact song, but the names are different, do you think that's a Z100 record?
It's so generic that I'm like, I want to say no, but that probably means yes.
Probably means yes. So again, it'll be interesting to see where this goes over the course of the summer. It'll be interesting to see if the tour does in fact pick back up. Are fans going to reject it? Or has he lost some percentage of the fan base? And also, I think like the bigger conversation about like what is the role of a person like this as Nashville's biggest star, and how does Nashville, with their institutions, award shows, labels, radio stations, continue or not continue to reckon with this happening right in their midst?
Just flat out, do you think this is a good song? If tomorrow. Okay.
Ish. 7.5.
Oh, okay.
7.
All right.
7.2.
And you think it's going to work?
I think it's designed to work.
Yes.
Quote unquote.
Without a doubt.
I don't know if it'll work.
Right.
But it's designed to work. And I think whether it works or not will be an interesting litmus test of what spaces Morgan Wallen is allowed into, and to some degree, Lil Durk is permitted into. But like, I do think it's probably a referendum on Wallen at this moment more than it is on Durk. That's my guess. Speaking of scores,
I was going to say the way you were describing, will this work from this sort of like microcosm? Like, this is happening. This is happening on a smaller level with another artist who I know you want to talk about.
Yeah, well, a lot of people want to talk about.
Yeah, or do they?
This year, a very important public figure turns 80. He sent us his wish for his birthday.
My wish is for everyone to practice wildfire safety, because only you can prevent wildfires.
That sounds easy enough. Bet you don't know who it is. Nah, of course you do. It's Smokey Bear. Let's all make sure Smokey's wish comes true by learning his wildfire prevention tips at SmokeyBear.com. Because Smokey Bear lives within us all. Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Every week on Popcast Deluxe, we are going to take a question, a John and Joe question. This week, it being week one, the John and Joe question is came from the ether.
Came from inside the house.
It came from inside the house. It came from upstairs.
Yeah.
Sam Sifton, who is in charge of the culture coverage here, went over to the desk of Karen Gans, our editor, and said, I don't want to do a Sam accent, but yeah, yeah. But like,
you think Sam has an accent?
Yeah, yeah, kind of. I don't want to do it, but like, I think in essence, the question was, what's up with the dare?
What is up with the dare?
Which, to be fair, is a question that I have been asking, Joe has been asking, all of our dearest friends have been asking for 8 months at this point, about, 9 months.
Yeah.
So the dare is Harrison Patrick Smith. It is a one individual project. And the dare released a song last year called Girls.
I like the girls that do drugs. Girls with cigarettes in the back of the club. Girls that hate cops and bad girls.
Is a great record to me. I know. To me, it's a great record.
It was on your songs of the year list.
It was on my songs of the year list.
Yeah.
Girls is, depending who you ask, updated electro clash, whatever indie sleaze might be. We'll probably do an episode on that. It's on indie sleaze because that's not real.
Harrison might have to come for that one.
Yeah, seriously.
Defend himself.
Harrison's going to be like splayed out like Burt Reynolds here during the indie sleaze episode. Someone suggested to me that it was basically a ripoff of Cake.
Wow. Yeah. I haven't heard that one.
Oh, yeah. Shout out. You know who you are.
Bloghouse.
Sure. Bloghouse, yeah.
LCD like, sound system.
Yeah,
the
sure.
Rapture, dance punk.
Uffy.
Early 2000s.
We were at the parties. I was at the parties.
Turn of the century. Parties? I got here in 2006.
Seems kind of right at the tail end.
Misshapes was happening. Yeah, you know what I mean? I think this is actually an interesting divide. I think people are failing to differentiate between Meet Me in the Bathroom, alt rock.
Not the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the Strokes, New York retro garage rock moment.
Yeah.
And the sort of Cobra Snake, neon sunglasses.
BPM is like high
dance
BPM.
Music.
118, 122, 124 BPM.
There were people with feet in both worlds, but one
and
sort
the
of,
scenes are very nearby.
And one led
and,
into the
and
other.
I would actually say some of the outfits in the early phases are pretty
similar. A lot of American Apparel.
Yeah, like it peeled off at a certain point.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yes, the pants are Marnie. Thank you for asking. So The Dare has an EP that came out.
The Sex EP.
Yes. And there's a song called Sex, which is very spiritually kin to Girls.
But less funny.
It's, yes. I think The Dare is basically very good and maybe should be even a tiny bit dumber.
Okay, but we should pull back and say that we're fully in the midst of round one of backlash against The Dare, which I think...
Which, and I want to emphasize, more than likely, you have never heard of.
Which is crazy, yes. To me, it boils down to this question, which is, does New York matter? And does New York matter more than culture being made in other places?
Okay, so I want to start by saying something that Bob Criscow once told me. Shout out Bob.
Face to face?
Yeah. And I think he says this in other contexts, but he did tell me this face to face. Bob, been in the game for years, and made him an animal. I just want to be clear. Bob said, we were talking about covering live music in New York, and Bob has been doing this since the 70s.
Right.
The
60s. The rock critic.
Like literally the dean. And he was basically like, a band playing in New York is news. It's noteworthy. Inherently, it's noteworthy.
If you can make it here.
Truly. It's like what is happening here, the scenes here, the venues. If you come from outside and play here, that's noteworthy. You have attention. You have people looking at you. If you come from here and you like come up through the scene, that's noteworthy. And I'm not saying there aren't noteworthy scenes in Cleveland or Dallas, Fargo. Like, I'm not saying any of that. But Bob said that to me. It has always stuck with me. Obviously, thinking about that in the CBGB 70s is
I know, it's an old
now.
School idea.
It's an old school idea, but I do still think there is some residue, especially because, let's keep it a buck, most people who work in music media probably live within a 6-mile radius of where we're sitting right now.
Do you think it's because stuff started here? Like, whatever, hip-hop, Broadway.
Sorry, punk. Apologies to all British people.
Sure, disagree. But like... You know, not really.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have to litigate
right
now.
Our British
but I'm saying, like, does
go
that...
down after this?
Like, the fact that it's, like, a birthplace of culture means that any culture here is more important from the jump?
I have a more grim read on it, which is that the type of person who is likely to see themselves as having an important point of view are liable to be people who have arrived in New York and are looking for a thing that complements their arrival in New York.
Right.
That said, if I were to say to you, what's the Dare of 2017? I'm not sure there was a Dare of 2017. Mm-hmm. 2011, maybe 2003 for sure. But like, 2017, no, maybe that part of New York wasn't popping.
It's interesting, though, that the backlash that we're seeing, you know, I'm thinking of like a mid to negative review in Pitchfork, a negative-ish review in Rolling Stone, you know, a lot of mean tweets. Like, they're coming in from people who either live in New York or have spent time in New York, who have watched this mini moment grow from its infancy or saw the original version of it. And yet there's still this like chip on the shoulder thing of like, we're not going to let this happen again. And I think some of that comes from the sort of dumbness that you described in the music, mm-hmm. which I think is intentional. And he hasn't really defined his character yet in the public. There was a GQ story that sort of scratched the surface, but he hasn't really announced himself and sort of what his ideologies are creatively. And yeah, it's like a straight white guy talking about sex in a way that feels to me distinctly post-pandemic and Me Too. And it's sort of like, it's like the non-political, non-ideological version of like, we weren't supposed to be able to do this anymore.
But it's still done with like a tiny sprinkle of irony.
That's, no, I think bigger than a tiny sprinkle.
Comedy. Like, and I think, is that the way that those topics are going to get kind of like a Trojan horsed back into the discourse? Like through this sort of like, right. I'm going to do the dumbest possible verse about sex, the dumbest possible. And actually, for the record, I don't think it's the dumbest possible. I think they could be dumber.
Right.
But is that really what's happening here? Was it sort of, you think it's like idea first, execution second?
I think maybe, but also it's so fledgling. Like people are really trying to strangle the dare in its crib, you know? And like, I almost think that that ultimately will make him stronger. Like, people are going to,
of course,
like the backlash at this early stage, I think is the best possible thing for the career. And I think that the mechanisms are already cranking, signed to a major label, performing at Fashion Weeks, being flown out by brands, you know, working with different producer, like getting in the studio with so-and-so.
Looks
like
great all, in the suit.
Yeah, like, you know, clothes are better. Like everything, like it's cranking. So that's why I'm like, I'm not amenable to the argument that we shouldn't be covering this because it's just some tiny thing in New York. It's like, no, no, like the people with power have decided that this is a project that they care about. Like we've seen that, we've heard that, we've been hearing this chatter for months. You know, these are how scenes are built. Like label guys are not geniuses, but what they say goes. You know what I mean? I'm like, they decide what culture gets to spread.
Okay. I feel like the words that you're trying to say, but you're failing to say, are Matty Healy. I feel like that's where, like you want to talk about someone Trojan horsing ideas into post-Me Too culture, like with their popularity and causing quite a conflagration, should I say.
We're going to say...
Where are we, like, how long before the dare is Matty Healy discourse level?
If they are not in the studio together by the end of the summer, I will be surprised.
By the end of this podcast, they will be. We did... Look, I'm just saying, we did it for Taylor and Ice Spice.
It's true.
We did that.
We spoke it into being.
We did that.
I think Maddie and Harrison would have a lot to talk about musically and culturally.
And we're just going to leave it there. And then when that happens 6 to 12 months from now, we're going to cut this in right there.
And we'll talk about it some more.
All right. You want to talk about other things that happened in New York and have happened over the years? Your early career, Joey Blogs?
Oh, okay. All right. We're going to shift. We're going to shift mediums.
Yeah. Again, you want to talk about the indie sleaze of media.
It's true.
Joey Blogs.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yep. The Gawker era.
Can you talk to me about what it was like to be young and watching this? Like, I sort of like, I don't know if I lived it, but I was like there. I saw it was like, you know, I felt like a...
But you were a grown up.
Debatable. But I was of age, but whether I was a grown up is debatable. You're watching this a little bit and almost like learning how to...
Yeah.
Creatively contribute to the media through that lens, not simply through the lens of magazines and newspapers and so on. So
yeah, so we're talking about this new movie, Queenmakers.
Queenmakers on Hulu.
On Hulu.
And Queenmaker is in part about how the early gossip blog era was intertwined with the arrival of, I guess, the modern socialite.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's the thesis statement. It's like about it girls, socialites, but then narrows down to be about a much more specific story, which I think is really interesting.
But can you talk about the era?
Yeah, I mean,
the lawlessness of the era.
So it was partially what drew me to New York in the first place, which is like being able to go
to write
on,
about the Dare.
Yeah, to write about that. to podcast on YouTube about the Dare.
Here's the thing. Joe was so ahead that he came in. What year did you come to New York?
2006.
2006.
Summer 2006.
You came here in you waited 17 years to YouTube pod about the Dare. It's incredible. What a patient guy. So patient.
The Harrison was literally in his crib at that point when I moved to New York.
You knew.
But there was this wave of unofficial sort of like guerrilla media and celebrity happening.
Yes.
The documentary Queen Makers
literally just never take me to Scratcher Bar again.
When was the last time you were in Scratcher?
Actually, not that long ago, but like never take me there.
Yeah. Please. I went to Scratcher last night.
No, you didn't.
I did. After I saw a movie at Angelica Film Center.
Truly.
Just like it was 2006.
Literally Indie Sleaze Lives.
Yeah. Okay. The documentary jumps pretty quickly from the Hilton sisters mm-hmm. to Tinsley Mortimer mm-hmm. to Olivia Palermo and Gawk.
Frankly, not enough in Olivia Palermo if we're going to keep it a buck.
Though she is interviewed.
She is interviewed and I think... I like her resistance. I like how
she doesn't want to be there.
She doesn't want to be like, she's unhappy. Yeah. She's like, I almost like can't believe I agreed to do this.
Yeah.
It's not like the vibe. Like, it's like she sat down and she was just like, the vibe's off. But like, I'm here. I did the hair and makeup. Like, let's just get through this.
Yeah.
Anyway, more Olivia Palermo. I'd like to see that. The bonus footage. Right?
Yeah. And I think that this world started in the traditional gossip pages, Page Six, New York Post. And then the meta version, which was springing up, is the Gawker Medias of the world, the Socialite Rank website. Mm-hmm. What's the other one called?
Park Avenue Peerage.
And these are people with no training, no bosses mm-hmm. really, that can say whatever they want, be as mean as they want. Some are anonymous, some are not. This is the rise of Perez Hilton. Mm-hmm. All this. This was an exciting time. This was like a democratization of the press.
So you say.
So I said. I mean, like, for somebody coming up at that time, mm-hmm. LiveJournal, MySpace, Blogspot, WordPress, mm-hmm. Tumblr, and so on and so on. Like
RSS on Fleek.
Yeah. I mean, this was like a lot of this, like, and this movie, this documentary tells that story in the background. And I thought it did an okay job at it. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a little bit ahistorical, like the recent New York Magazine package on the It Girl, mm-hmm. I think had a wider, longer, deeper view. This is sort of like fast forwarded through.
But it felt like it was fast forwarding through it in order to get to its real subject.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, did the film work for you once it, at sort of the halfway point, reaches what I think is the story that it really wanted to tell?
I thought the second half of the film, which focuses on the person who created Park Avenue Peerage. Park Avenue Peerage was a sort of affectionate document, an affectionate document of socialite culture.
Right. From afar,
written by...
We won't spoil it.
No.
You should watch the movie. That, are you recommending it or are you not recommending
it? I am recommending
it. If you know who Olivia Palermo is, you should watch the movie.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying I'm saying maybe we should spoil it a little bit. No?
I don't think so. Are we a spoiler podcast?
It's like been out 2 weeks.
I just don't, all right.
It was spoiled for me before I watched it.
You let me come to the twist on my own.
Yeah. Okay, the person who did Park Avenue Peerage, which was the sort of like affectionate socialite rank. Socialite rank had been seen as caustic and pitting people against each other.
Snarky was the word of the time.
Wow. I'm going to get you a
snarky,
like a varsity type sweatshirt.
Yeah.
Snark.
Yeah.
Snark you. That person has undergone tremendous life changes.
Yeah.
And the second half of the film is devoted to those tremendous life changes. And the ways in which the heartbreak of the first era led to these tremendous life changes. I thought the story in the second half of the film is a better story. I thought the film was not as good.
Mm.
I thought the film was better in the beginning, in the first half, even if the story of the first half is like not quite as good.
Yeah, I think this is, it's such a rich topic, and I think it's worth it to give it the sort of catchy framing of Paris Hilton and the It Girls to be able to tell this very specific tale of, yeah, how this world sort of shaped someone's imagination from afar and then was able to enter that realm and
sort of,
and how it...
But also the ways in which that world is not set up to accommodate difference.
Yes.
Not set up to accommodate racial difference, not set up to accommodate class difference, like not set up to accommodate just like... It is the most insider-outsider place that you can possibly imagine. And it was interesting to see how quickly it all crumbled the minute that that person comes to New York, the city, interns at New York, the magazine, and starts trying to go to these events. And all of a sudden, the whole thing kind of like crumbles.
Yeah, I think...
And without giving away too much about the twist, the concluding scene of the film is, I think, meant to literalize something that could not have been literalized back in 2006 or whatever, which is there is a novelty to that person going to one of those events in 2006. In 2021 or 2022, two things are happening. One, I'm going to spoil one part. This person never actually makes it in the door of the event to recreate the moment of meeting Tinsley Mortimer, which was like a foundational moment in the first wave.
Yeah.
The second thing that I think went unremarked upon is looked how desiccated that event felt. That it's event true. Is in Chicago. I apologize. It's not in New York. It's in Chicago.
Which I'm sorry. We know.
I enjoy Chicago. I had a great time. Shout out George Green. Happy to, great times.
Yeah.
It's in Chicago. It is for dog. It's an event for people in their dressed
for dogs,
up pets.
Actual dogs.
Yeah. Literally, it's for dressed up pets.
Yeah.
So it's like people have gone through a lot of life changes. People have evolved. People have maybe fallen from their perches or their perches have moved. It is not simply the blogger's perch that has moved. It is also the socialite perch.
I think that it's a really fascinating document of a niche but influential time. I think recommend it to fans of Gossip Girl. If you know who Emily Gould is, you should watch
Friend
this.
Friend of the pod. Shout out Emily Gould. And also, can I say something about the Emily Gould bit in there? I had not watched the CNN Jimmy Kimmel like face-off.
Right.
Probably since it happened.
Former Gawker blogger Emily Gould.
Right. Sort of going on the Larry King show, guest hosted by Jimmy Kimmel.
To defend Gawker, basically.
And defend Gawker Stalker, which at that time was basically like, oh.
It was the original Dumois.
Yes, literally. Like, now we don't even think about it. Like, but it's literally like, oh, I saw Joe Coscarelli.
Spotted Joe Biden, Washington, D.C.
Yes, like, literally like that. And so she ends up being the face of Gawker and Gawker Stalker. And then Jimmy Kimmel, like, sort of, like, lures her in. And then it's basically like, by the way, you're a terrible person. I'm not drunk in public, yada, yada, yada.
Honestly, I think that there's a shifting definition of what is public and what is private space for everyone, not just celebrities. The internet, blogs, MySpace, no one has the reasonable expectation of being able to walk down the street and not have what they're doing be noticed by someone
anymore.
Well,
that is just a terrible thing, though, isn't it? I mean,
just is it really?
I thought the way that Emily discussed the end of the presumption of the average person's privacy is very prophetic.
Mm.
And even I think in the most generous read of how that clip played out in 2000, whatever, I think that part never quite got the play. It was more Kimmel being like,
yeah, it was the ambush.
Yeah. But like, I actually thought, and that part, her defense of it comes late in the clip. And I actually thought it was really admirable to kind of be like, I just eating all this, this stew that's getting thrown at me by the host for 4 minutes, and then to sort of have this very robust defense of something that, look, I'm sure we all don't like it. Like, nobody likes to be like talked about in a way that they're not expecting.
Sure.
But it is unfortunately a fact of the modern internet. And certainly, I mean, we're now at the point where we're having ethics debates about, like, can you photograph someone on the train and put it on TikTok, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Like,
or at a baseball game.
At a baseball game. And so I thought seeing that clip now with fresh eyes and with 15 years of perspective was actually quite prophetic.
I think people should check out this movie if you care at all about any of the proper nouns we've said in the last 5 minutes.
If you care about Joe, if you ever went on joecoscarelli.com, still active, by the way, if you ever went on joecoscarelli.com or ever clicked through a link on joecoscarelli.com to a John Caramonica article, if you ever did that.
It's probably how we met.
I almost certainly. Yeah. So you should check out the film. Absolutely. Should we talk about one other TV thing?
Yeah. What else have you been watching?
Well, I mean, I mean, here we sit.
There was only one thing to watch last night. Speaking of the early 2000s,
both Joe and I are big Survivor heads.
Yeah.
Survivor finale.
Survivor. All right. I just want to get this out of the way. Yes, Survivor.
Can you explain what Survivor is?
Yes, Survivor is still on.
Yes.
Yes, it's on. It's 44th season.
Season
44.
Yeah.
44 seasons of Survivor. It has never gone away. Since I know you remember Richard Hatch.
Yeah. It's never gotten bad.
There's some duds, but never a long stretch. Although this most recent stretch, I think, was really struggling until this season.
It's a really good season.
Finale of 44 last night. Mm-hmm. We're going to spoil it.
Yeah. Why are we spoiling this, but not the other thing?
Because one was a live television event and one is a streaming film that has much less juice than primetime on CBS.
Okay, we're going to revisit the no spoiler policy at some point. Because I think it's fine to spoil. And I think if you show up here and you're just like, if you're going to send a whiny email about spoiling, then like you're not for us and we're not for you. But it's okay. It's totally fine. Choose your right size your audience.
It's true.
It's totally fine.
How'd you feel after last night?
Jam won.
Yeah.
I am not surprised. Yeah. I thought it was obviously very smart of them. Okay. So what ended up happening is there were three people who were sort of outcasts. They were on the sort of least powerful tribe. And frankly, amongst themselves, we're talking Carolyn, Jam Jam, and Carson.
Yeah.
Each of whom in their own, a classic kind of like Survivor archetype on their own.
That's the main thing that struck me about this season that was lacking in the last couple is that on any other Survivor season, any one of them would have been the star.
Yes.
Survivor has been so good, like The Bachelor, Real World, sort of The Challenge, at birthing its own mythology and its own recurring characters.
Yeah.
And we've been sorely lacking in classic Survivor
archetype
repeat
characters.
All stars. They'll definitely come back. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like people who the moment you see them, you're like, you are now part of the Survivor
lore. This is lore.
Yes. And we could have done with any one of them. We got three in one season,
and
incredible.
And the fact that they were on the same tribe, that they worked together
in an old school alliance.
In an old school alliance successfully, when frankly, all three of them are unstable in different ways.
Yeah.
Like Carson is unstable because he's so analytical that he's liable to look at his alliance and say, absolutely not. Now's the time to X these people out.
Yeah.
Jam Jam's unstable because his social game is so good.
He's friends really with everyone.
Friends with everybody, allied with everybody. The odds that he's going to stay true to his core alliance, not that high.
Yeah.
Carolyn, unstable because played just a very unpredictable, emotionally vulnerable and transparent game to the point where nobody, on purpose, but people... What people had some difficulty identifying where the gameplay was.
Yeah.
And I think that's what she was trying to argue for. But I also think it's why she didn't get any votes in the end.
I couldn't believe it.
You thought she was going to win.
I thought I was watching. I think I let my heart get the best of me.
Oh.
I thought we were watching Carolyn's story the entire run.
My entire life, people are constantly saying Carolyn's kind of loud. Carolyn's a little bit crazy. Carolyn's a little emotional. But I am coming out here as somebody who loves and accepts myself.
I was like, oh, she's taking it. Like, I was like, they know that the producers are as in love with her as the audience. And like,
that's so funny.
It tells
me a lot about you that you thought that that's what was happening with the Carolyn arc of the season.
And I just thought she would be able to convey to everyone that while she seemed like a mess, she was really in total control.
Yeah.
She made a couple moves throughout the season that I didn't think she had in her. And she used...
Playing the idol for Carson.
Yes. Yep. And she used her outward kookiness to throw everybody off the scent. Absolutely. She was always a threat and nobody ever named her as a threat.
To me, the reason I felt like I felt fairly confident. I mean, I thought it was being Carson or Jam Jam, but like when they got rid
but
of Carson.
But Carson didn't even make the final. He lost in the fire making.
Right. But like when the
got
reason
washed
I
washed by Heidi.
Like it wasn't even like Carson did so much crying early in the episode about his failure to make fire. I actually thought, talk about a redemption arc. I was like, oh, he's definitely winning fire. Oh, like I thought they were setting him up to overcome.
Yeah.
And actually they were just setting him up to be like, yep.
No, Heidi is just like, I mean, no. Bless her. She was never going to win.
The whole thing.
Yeah, she was never going to win the show. Mm-hmm. Crazy that she got to the end. Mm-hmm. Fine character. Mm-hmm. Sort of a, you know, she was a placeholder.
Yeah, relatively neutral.
Yeah, but you thought Carson, if Carson would have won Fire, you think you would have won?
I think Carson absolutely would have won. The thing about Jam Jam, and over the course of the season, you following... Carolyn, I'm following Jam Jam. The reason is because I kept waiting for him to be a villain.
Right, he was not.
And I think
a truly good person, maybe.
And also, I felt like the producers kept waiting for him to be a villain. And they were stitching together just the faintest little things, mm-hmm. little throwaway sentences here and there to make him seem like he actually is going to stab people in the back. But every time he was presented mm-hmm. with an opportunity to stab someone truly close to him in the back, he just said, I can't do it.
Josh, the person I'm trying to take out, he said Kane as a vote, which is a great idea. You know, but I like Kane. I don't want to write Kane's name down.
It's not in my
heart.
He's
a big softie.
Yeah, like truly.
Yeah.
And so once he made it into the final three, I was like, there's no universe in which he doesn't win.
I mean, he was the most popular person in this tribe.
Like, he's going to be the new Jeff Probst.
Yeah.
Like when Probst retires, it's Jam Jam.
In all time orator.
He's going to be the Ken Jennings. He's the Ken Jennings of future Survivor.
Totally possible. Beyond winning, so funny, so warm, so charming, deserved his win.
Jam Jam, yeah, we might have to pull Jam Jam.
Yeah, I mean, Jam Jam, come on Popcast Deluxe anytime.
We're going to have the dare 1 week, Jam Jam the next week.
And nobody's going to understand what's going on. If you've made it this far and you haven't watched Survivor since the glory days, like,
get involved.
Just go watch the whole thing. Survivor is the most, it's nourishing. It's amazing. It's wonderful. It's some of the best documentary mm-hmm. made of our in our lifetime. Mm-hmm. It's probably the second best show of all time.
After
Sopranos.
Oh.
Succession. Just kidding.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. Also, I think, you know, CBS had a mandate a few years ago to improve diversity in the casting. I think they've done a really good job spreading out the cast. I think they always did a good job identifying good emotional characters, and now they've finally doubled down
of casting Survivor impressive. Throughout its whole
also,
history.
Also, Jeff Probst, like, put him in the Hall of Fame, put him absolutely in the Hall of Fame. So present.
44 seasons,
man,
never slipped.
What a titan!
Titan.
All right, we're also going to do every week, we're going to do songs of the week. We're going to pivot away from Survivor. All right, we're both going to do songs of the week.
Okay.
Right? You want to go first? You want me to go first?
You give me what you got.
Okay. I listen to a lot of Youngboy. There's so much to listen to. It's like it's like Jandek.
I'm like five albums behind.
Yeah, and you just like couldn't
I actively listen to
it. Like literally just couldn't possibly absorb it all. But I was listening to Richest Stop.
The newest album.
Yeah, newest album. I was listening to it in the car the other day, and there's a song on there called Dirty Thug. And the reasons that I and many others love, I mean, Youngboy is the most popular artist on YouTube, like not, like maybe Bad Bunny is more popular, but basically the most popular.
A humongous
star that artist. A lot of people don't know about, but he's huge. Has such like a direct line to like a raw emotional expression. The songs really do feel the basically like when I try to write something, like I try to clear out the path from the brain to my fingers.
Yeah.
He's whatever he's that is. Of that. He's just incredibly, it's so quick and lucid. And you feel the immediacy of it, but it doesn't take away from the structuredness of it. They're still well-structured songs, but they feel immediate. And I believe, based on everything you ever heard or seen about his recording approach and his output level, I imagine that's because they are.
Yeah.
And something about the vocal on this song, which we should just listen to for a second, but something about the vocal right at the top of this song, just real, like...
Every now and then, he just can really... It's just punch.
It's overwhelming.
I take these drugs with no party. I told that girl that I'm sorry. I seen what was said and it scarred me. Guess what got me again this way? What the fuck? I can't get mad. They love. I ain't enough. I'ma try and find happiness in myself. I lost my trust. See me with no angel in it, girl. I lost my love.
Yeah. So anyway, that is the song I find in certain contexts when people ask me, how do I find music or how do I like approach thinking about music critically, which I've been doing for an unbearably long period of time of my life.
Since I was on Tumblr.
Since
before I was on Tumblr.
Since Joe was thinking about YouTubing about the dare when Joe is in the crib. A thing that I say is I like to be jolted.
Yeah.
And oftentimes...
Especially today. Like in this moment.
Yeah, so much. Everything is like a little bit fuzzy. I like to be jolted. And often what I mean is I want to be jolted by an idea or an ideology that I haven't heard before or a perspective, but sometimes you get jolted. I mean, you know, I'm not going to be here like Sam Cooke, A Change Is Gonna Come,
right?
NBA Youngboy, Dirty Thug. Like, I'm not going to do that. But like, sometimes a vocal hits in such a pure way that it destabilizes you. That's out. Like when this came on in the car, like I was like,
yeah, you had to stop and listen.
Very, very intense.
What more could you want?
Physical reaction.
Out of music. Anyway. Yeah. Speaking of jolts.
And also speaking of the endless vomit stream of contemporary pop culture.
It's true. My song of the week, new old Lana Del Rey.
New old Lana.
Say Yes to Heaven.
Yeah.
Sped up version.
Okay. Official release.
Official. This is as good to me from a music business angle as it is from an artistic side, which is this is a Lana Del Rey song that has nothing to do with the album that Lana Del Rey just put out. It is an old leak from a decade ago that has always had some...
it's like a connoisseur
mythology.
Record.
Yeah,
it's like a connoisseur record.
Lana fans, like Youngboy fans, collect leaks. They collect snippets. They wish for these songs that are never going to come out officially. But I think this one got a little bit of heat on TikTok, whatever. Lana and the label get together and they say, you know what? We're going to put out Say Yes to Heaven. And we're also going to package it with a sped up remix version. You talked about sped up remixes.
On regular podcasts this week, Elias from Billboard came on. We were talking about the Miguel Sure Thing record, Thundercat record.
Yeah.
So fast remixes, just the short version fast remixes on TikTok have become a thing. Probably just because everybody has ADD and like needs to hear things either quickly or also at a pitch that kind of like, you're like, what?
Yeah.
Or why is that voice like that? It's an attention getting device. It also like is an interesting complement for different kinds of choreography, different kinds of jump cuts.
Sometimes it dodges robots that try to take down copyright songs.
Like there's
there's like a sort of
until the bots absorb the official versions.
Right.
So anyway, if you want to hear more about sped up remixes, if you listen to original podcast, we've got an hour on there talking about how labels are coping, how artists are coping, etc. But it's interesting to see someone like Lana, who I would imagine is like pretty precious about the art.
Yes.
Kind of be like, yeah, pitch it up 30%.
Do
like,
it. Whatever. Just go. So she's chipmunked up on this song. The song really works for me. I'm not like a sped up remix guy. Like it's not something that I'm spending a lot of time listening to, but for it's
you're
funny.
Not 12.
Right. But Lana is a slow core artist in a lot of ways.
Yeah, of course.
So, but this is back in a time when she was still writing tighter pop oriented mm-hmm. songs. And then to add another layer of like pop beamed in from 10 years later onto it. Like, I just think it's a really interesting artifact, but it also works for me on a musical level. So,
and also I should say, like, one thing TikTok does really well, intentionally or not, is it really just does collapse the idea of history.
Yeah.
It's like, it genuinely doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like,
is it new? Is it old? Is it supposed to sound like this? Is it not?
Truly, who knows?
Yeah.
One thing that came up on Popcast is some executive said to Elias, for a story that he was working on, like, are we like making songs or are we just like giving clay to people and then they do what they want? And it's like, I regret to inform you, y'all are clay. You want to listen?
Yeah, it's clay. Let's go. It's good clay.
It's good clay.
If you dance, I'll dance. And if you don't, I'll dance anyway. Give peace a chance. Let the fear.
Finish up.
I mean, first of all, I promise I will never stop going in.
Is it time for dessert?
I like to lead with dessert, but yeah.
All right.
One other thing, we're going to close out every episode. Joe and I are both, I would say, devoted snack connoisseurs.
Yeah.
We have different palates, we have different tolerances mm-hmm. for flavor, spice, texture. But
we love junk food.
We love junk food, and I will be at a corner store. I'll be at a bodega, and I will see something novel, and I'll take a picture of it and send it to Joe. And Joe will be like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, I got it first. I already been there." So I brought something, but actually, I think we're gonna save this for right. next episode because I think this is the logical answer yeah. to what we're about to.
This
have.
Is not available at bodegas,
not yet.
This is banana bread. With chocolate chips, it looks like, baked by the one and only Karen Gans, our editor, frequent guest on Popcast.
Yes. This is a housewarming gift for Popcast Deluxe.
Yeah. And I already know it's delicious. I would never say otherwise.
Uh-oh. So I have to say otherwise, is what you're saying?
Do you like banana bread?
This yeah, is sure. Is that, are there walnuts in here, though?
Yes. That's not there, or there's walnuts on top. I don't know if they're inside. You don't eat walnuts?
Wow, it's soft.
Mm.
Really soft.
Mm-hmm.
Good job. Good job on texture, first of all.
You're going Paul Hollywood on us?
Yeah. Karen did it.
It's hitting.
Karen, you did that.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I thought it would not be this good.
It's really good.
But I thought it would not be this good.
Yeah.
Like, truly.
Every now and then, an extremely low moment, I'll go to Starbucks and I'll get a piece of banana bread.
That's dark.
And they warm it up for you.
Even still.
This is better.
Karen, felicidad.
Yeah.
Like, truly great.
Truly Incredible. Great. Thank you.
Episode 1, Popcast Deluxe in the books. You're Joe Coscarelli.
John Caramonica.
Look, catch us every week, youtube.com/NYTimes or NYT Audio, wherever we're going to end up being. Listen to Popcast, all versions, audio only and video / audio at nytimes.com/popcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Facebook, get in the Discord, tinyurl.com/popcast/facebook/popcast/discord. If you want a sticker, should I?
We got stickers.
If you like Cameron's Purple Haze and you like stickers and you want to put things on your laptop, it's the podcast.myshopify.com. Profits go to the New York Times Neediest Cases Fund. Leslie Davis is our director and producer. Pedro Rosado handling all of our audio on the audio feed. Karen Gans, of course, Nell Galogli. The video team here that has allowed us into their space and made this a comfortable environment for us. I'm talking Abe Sader. I'm talking Mike Cordero. I'm talking Craig Hedich.
I think you got it. Episode 1 in the books. Popcast Deluxe. Come back next week.
Big things coming.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. If approved, applications are typically funded the next business day or sooner. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.